All right. Good evening. I think we're on. Yes. All right. And welcome to our special joint meeting of the City Council and Planning Commission. It is Monday, November 30th. And just to let everyone know how this is going to work, we're going to have three public comment periods. The first one, we're having a special City Council meeting on a declaration ending our water emergency. We will have public comment before that on that issue only. After that, we'll have public comment on our general joint meeting agenda, and then we're going to have our first presentation, which is from the Visioning Subcommittee, and after that presentation, we'll have public comment on that specific issue, because we do want input on that after the presentation. So that's how...
Duff's kitchen and enjoy folk dancing, children's dancing, school choirs, and music all day long. Again, that's December 12th from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., at the South Bay Community Center, and this is for the Maxine Lewis Homeless Shelter. And you can bring gifts if you like to donate, and or you can just come and enjoy that day and support the homeless shelter. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any other announcements from council?
Yes, I have one, if I could, real quick. To follow up that evening, from 5 to 8 up in the Fresno Street area of Morro Bay is the Illuminaries this year. So encourage everyone to go take a walk through the neighborhood.
Yes, that's quite a beautiful display. We also have our boat parade coming up on the 5th, which is Saturday, and the tree lighting on the 6th, which is Sunday. Okay, all the announcements. And the Caroline Cock Choirs, what are the dates for that?
It's going to be Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday.
Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I believe. I think it's the 7th, 8th, and 9th.
Next week? Okay, yeah. That'll be the 8th, 9th, and 10th, probably. Okay. All right, so now we will get to the business at hand. And, Bruce, are you doing this presentation?
Actually, Madam Mayor, Dylan Wade, our capital projects and utility engineer, is going to give you the report on the moratorium. We've got some late developments on the state water project.
Oh, sorry. We should have the public comment first.
Oh, excuse me.
Public comment on the water emergency declaration. Anyone wishing to speak on that? Okay, seeing none. Dylan, thank you.
Good evening, Madam Mayor, members of the council. We're here tonight, a very brief staff report and then also an update. Actually, the state water project shutdown ran this year from November 1st through November 23rd. I got a phone call at 4:45 tonight that actually a pumping station had some problems, and so we're in a short-term state water shutdown as of this evening, and that should continue for the next several days. So the one change that I would make to the action that you're taking tonight is request that this be we take the action tonight, but we postpone actually implementation until Monday is what I would request. And that would effectively keep us under conservation measures until Monday, December 7th, I believe it would be the date. But with that, what we're asking for tonight in very short terms, and I'll keep my report very brief, is we're coming out of the period of the state water shutdown, and so we have state water restored to us as a source, and as such, we should exit that emergency period that losing the state water as our main source of supply causes us to be in. And so we're here tonight to request from the council that you rescind that emergency condition and restore normal deliveries of water to the community. So that was all that I had for my report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are we sure that the glitch is going to be fixed by Monday, or should we have the direction as such time as it's running again?
I would be fine with that direction. That would be appropriate as
okay.
Such time as it's running again. No matter when it is, it'll take us a couple days to put a mailer together and to get the message sort of out to the community in some form of official fashion. So that's why I thought we would pick a date. Once we kind of knew when the end of it certainly was, that we would pick a date. So we could make it generic direction when it's actually over,
okay.
And then staff will act accordingly.
Okay. Questions or comments from the council? Rick?
I posed a question to Dylan earlier because I was concerned about going back, to our previous levels as far as the water, because we still have a drought, we still have problems. And my question was, we pay for a certain amount of water. We pay for a minimum amount set by the state. And so what I was talking to Dylan about and what I'd like to see done is take whatever measures that we have to take to use our allotted state water but to leave the wells and the desal plant aside? And is there a happy medium that we can come to with maintaining some type of water conservation, because I think it's the right thing to do. We haven't had the precipitation yet. All the experts are saying we're going to have a really nice wet winter, but we haven't seen it yet. And the state is still in a drought, and so I don't know if going back right now is really the prudent thing to do, but I'd like to see a happy medium where we're not paying for water that we're I don't want to be paying for water that we're not using. I want to use our allotment, but at the same time, if there's a happy medium, we can reach using that and not the wells and desal unit.
And I'll be happy to take a crack at that. That I could probably take an hour or two to get into great detail about how this really will work. So I'll try to keep it very simple. In simplest terms, state water can deliver to us a maximum of 109 acre feet in any given month. Our community demands vary throughout the year, from a low of probably 80 or 90 in January, February, sort of in the wet season when it's certain types of landscaping would see distress if we carry this out longer. We also have certain demands for usage. One of the big questions was, can I pressure wash my house? I'm getting ready to paint. And we said, no, you can't pressure wash under the level of restriction that we're at. So we found that we actually were able to curtail a certain amount of demands. For the long term, I don't know how sustainable that is in the long term, and that the longer we go, the more likely we are to see those demands start to creep back up on us. I think the community made a good effort. What I don't have a good feel for, because the community hasn't implemented a lot, is if we drop down a level or two of severity, what that actually translates into as far as a percentage reduction. And I think you would find that in the short term, those would be bigger percentage reductions. So let's say that right now we're at a severely restricted water supply. Let's say we ratchet it down to a moderately restricted. And if a severely is 10% reduction, then I would say the moderate would probably get you 5%. The slightly would get you 2.5% or something along those lines. So if we wanted to go long-term with some reduced level of or at some mandatory level of water supply restriction, we certainly would see a reduction in our demands. And what that would do for us is it would change the timing and date of when state water would no longer be able to meet our needs. So, for example, we would run longer into the year with state water meeting our needs as a resource. And rather than transitioning June 15th, we might transition June 20th or something like that. But what it won't do is get us to the point where we'll ever not need to augment state water in those peak demand periods.
But keeping some kind of restriction in until April shouldn't be a huge hardship.
No, I wouldn't. I mean, certainly there are segments of the community that have felt the hardship more than others. I wouldn't think it would be a huge hardship to keep some level of restriction. Where we're at, though, is we would I would think more from a technical standpoint, we'd have a hard time making a finding of necessity for that. In that state water, when it comes back on, at the current projected delivery level for next year, we'll be able to provide for all of our community's water's demand in January, February, March kind of a thing. And so that would be a choice certainly that the council could make, that we want to make those findings. If you wanted to do that, I think you'd have to direct staff to attempt to do that. At this point, I didn't really have those findings prepared. And it hadn't really done an analysis to determine sort of how we would declare an emergency now that this critical time period has passed. So if that was the council's choice, I think you guys would have to provide us some direction to do that, and we would have to do some legwork.
Okay. Rick, is that?
Madam Mayor?
Yeah, I was just wondering if Rick was finished.
I'll follow up on Mr. Grantham's comments, because I agree with where he's going with this, and I appreciate his leadership on that. That some kind of conservation measure should stay in effect. And I guess what I would like to see us do is maybe come back on the 14th, okay. And if you would come back with a level that would be appropriate.
because I, too, don't want to use the desal plant, as expensive as it is, unless we have to or put it off as long as possible. I think that's fair to the city and fair to the ratepayers. So maybe rather than stop now or give you a date now, we could come back on the 14th.
Okay, Carla?
Well, it's kind of ironic because my conversation with Councilmember Smuckler was exactly the same as the other two council members here. In regards to finding some sort of level of conservation, we can continue on since we've had drought for the last 3 years. But I was looking at the probably at the moderate level, and I think a 5% reduction would be great, and we would still be utilizing the water we're paying for. So if Mr. Wade can get us that information.
Let me sort of clarify how state water works. The way that it works, most of our cost for state water, probably 85 to 90% of it is fixed. So whether we receive a drop of state water or none at all, or our full allotment, we pay for it. That's the one thing that we're certain of, is that we have to write a check for that ability to receive state water. The rest of it is a variable cost. And so that variable cost, a fairly nominal amount compared to the fixed cost, really we pay for what we use. So if we don't use our full allotment in any given year, we don't pay the variable cost on the part that we don't use. So I just wanted to clarify that point.
Okay, Noah, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Oops. And I'm definitely in support of that sort of action as Mr. Grantham has recommended.
Okay, so you are approving what Mr. Grantham said.
From an engineering standpoint, the findings have to be based on some logical, rational methodology for me to make them. However, you guys may have some ability, or staff may, in the aggregate, may have some ability that I don't as a professional engineer to make findings.
Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? All right, can we have a roll call, please?
Mayor Peters?
Yes.
Vice Chair Winholz?
Yes.
Councilmember Borchardt?
Yes.
Councilmember Grantham?
Yes.
Councilmember Smuckler?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, thank you. I do want to say one thing just to the public about this issue. We really appreciate those of you who have complied with this cutback. I know some of you may never have gotten the message or didn't understand it, and hopefully we will get that information out even better next time. I also appreciate the neighbors who called and told us about people who hadn't gotten the word. It's not tattling. It's just a matter of informing them of the cutback and why. And most people who were then informed were very cooperative. So that does help. So thank you to all of you for your attention to that. All right. So that concludes our...
Madam Mayor?
Yes.
Can I just ask for a clarification? Between, say, the 7th and the 14th, will we go back off mandatory or...
I think not, because we weren't sure exactly when it was going to end anyway, and so we're looking for
going to
another level. So we'll leave it the way it is until the 14th.
Right.
Can we do that is my question, if we're back on state water and have no findings on that?
The meeting hasn't happened yet.
Well, we have a reason to go to the 7th, and we're coming back the following week with some suggestion of what we think may be justification.
Right. Okay. All right, so that concludes the council part of the special meeting. So now I will let the Planning Commission weigh in with their presence.
Okay, all planning commissioners are here in person. Oh, I thought I did. I'm sorry. Right up to my face. How's that?
Tip the microphone
up.
There you go.
You happy?
Perfect.
That's good enough?
And Noah, are you happy?
Can you hear us, Noah?
Yes.
All right. Establishing a quorum. All planning commissioners are here in person, so we have our quorum and are ready to begin and call the meeting to order.
Okay. Then we'll start with a public comment on any of the issues on this agenda except the downtown visioning. We'll have separate public comment on that. So anyone wishing to speak on any of those items? This would be on CEQA, on reducing planning commission meetings, discussion on the pedestrian plan, gray water systems, and affordable housing. Those are the items on our agenda tonight.
I
think the question is there a general public comment?
No, no, it's a special meeting.
I'm sorry, Madam Mayor, but that's not how it's described in the on our agenda.
I talked with the city attorney today. He said this is a special meeting, so it's limited to the items there.
Well, the previous meeting was special, but this isn't, I don't think. This is a regular joint meeting.
Mayor Peters, I think he was most concerned of the first meeting. Okay. I think that this meeting, while we were hoping people would focus on the issues at hand, 1 through 6, I think you can take public comment in
okay.
general. So.
All right. We don't have a crowd anyway, so I guess that's all right.
If you'd like a crowd, I can try and speak in stereo in the hope that it'll maybe make my impact greater. I'm getting a nod here from Bob. Does it not seem like it's coming over yet?
Yes.
He's disappeared in the back room. That sometimes. There. Okay. Couldn't see that. Great. Then I will use this opportunity for regular, I guess, comment. Good evening, Mayor and Council. My name is David Weissman, Outreach Coordinator, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. On April 2nd of this year, the Council here sent a letter to the California Legislature to support Assembly Bill 42 of our Assemblyman, Dr. Sam Blakesley. That legislation would have mandated that Pacific Gas and Electric conduct a three-dimensional seismic reflection map image of the newly discovered and existing faults offshore of the Diablo Canyon power plant. Of particular concern were the lessons learned from the town of Kashiwazaka, Japan, which was home to the world's largest nuclear reactor on an unstudied and undetected earthquake fault. Of specific interest to Morro Bay, as you noted in your letter, were the impacts to tourism and on that town, and that's a subject I'm not unfamiliar with from my years as the chairman of this city's promotion committee. In fact, if I may quote your letter of April, quote, hotels and inns in Kashiwazaka, Japan, hardest hit by the magnitude 6.8 earthquake on July 16th, have suffered roughly 30,000 cancellations for room reservations, city officials said Friday. According to the tourism office, sales at beach houses exceed regulatory control. This announcement from Pacific Gas and Electric should be met not with enthusiasm, but with some skepticism. The questions about seismic issues raised by you, elected leaders in Morro Bay, still remain unanswered. The studies have not been completed. Why is Pacific Gas and Electric in such a rush to push this through before completing the earthquake studies required by Dr. Blakesley, who has his PhD from UC Santa Barbara for his research in seismic scattering, micro-earthquake studies, and fault zone attenuation? It would seem the man would have reason to ask questions. We encourage this council to support our state ratepayer protection agencies, the Energy Commission and the Public Utilities Commission. We suggest that the council draft a letter to Public Utilities Commission Chairman Michael Peavy stating and signifying that as a potentially impacted community, you too request that all studies be completed, adopted, and recommendations implemented before any ratepayer money is given for license renewal. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Richard Margetson, I'm glad you decided to have general public comment. Mr. Grantham, you're well-trained. You know to spread the word about the Needs and Wishes fundraiser. That's what we're here to talk about tonight. Since the fundraiser was started 4 years ago, the homeless population has increased almost 60%. Luckily, the proceeds from the fundraiser have more than doubled in that time period. And the fundraiser now is the largest single fundraiser for the shelter in the county. The enumeration study that was just completed earlier in the year counted 3,900 homeless in this county, of which more than 1,000 are school-age children. The event is all day. It starts at 10 o'clock. It goes till roughly 8 o'clock at night. And what's unique about this event, everything in the room that you'll see that day is donated by someone. We have no overhead budget. That's why we take advantage of this free public access to get the word out. There's donations from every part of the county. And last year, we had at least one check in the register at the end of the event from every community in the county. There was representation. We have lunch with the supervisor. So if there's an issue, you want to talk to your county supervisor or any of the county supervisors about. They're auctioning themselves off for lunch with the supervisor. They've done that all 4 years. Last year, Adam Hill got the high bid. The year before, Mr. Gibson did. So they're in a little bit of a competition this year to see who ends up the high bidder this year. The other thing, Jerry's going to talk about the entertainment and some of the other things that are available at the event, but if anyone's interested in donating or needs more information about the event, you can call 528-5800, 528-5800, and Betty's been on the Leadership Council for the 10-year plan. I think Rick is the new representative to the Homeless Services Oversight Council. There's a member of your board who has a relative that will be performing at the event that Jerry will talk about. It's a great event. If you need to get in the spirit, come. And like I said, every penny from the event goes to the shelter. Thank you. We won't keep you.
Thank you.
I have flyers to pass out to.
Okay.
Thank you for having us. Jerry Walsh from Los Osos. I was asked to give the date and place again. It's December 12th, Saturday, at the South Bay Community Center behind the skate park at 2180 Palisades Avenue. And we'd really like to thank all of the merchants and restaurant owners and artists of Morro Bay. You've really come out in force to donate to this. And if you're a business member of the Chamber of Commerce, you'll be receiving a flyer in the next newsletter for this. If you would please post it at your place of business to encourage all of your customers to come. And we're going to have live entertainment all day. It's a very family-oriented event. No alcohol is served, although we have wine for sale, bottles of wine. And Colleen Wall's Morro Bay Chamber High School Choir is going to be performing from noon to 12:30, and her Los Osos Middle School Choir is performing from 11:30 to 12. Ann Tiber's Folk Dancer Group is performing from 1 to 1:30, and Mayor Peters' own niece, Taylor Peters, is going to be performing from 3 to 3:30. She's a lovely vocalist, accompanied by a classically trained pianist, Johnny Cannon. And Johnny is also...
Okay, we'll bring it back for business then. Okay, first time, any comments on comments, anyone? You were there? Okay. First item on business is the report and update from the Visioning Subcommittee. Is that you, Jerry?
Can we have the PowerPoint, please? Okay, this is a report of the subcommittee for the Downtown Visioning Subcommittee. And this was, members were Noah Smuckler, John Diodati, and myself, Jerry Luhr. We'll be presenting a quick background. We'll present the documents that we reviewed and also be presenting an opportunity that we have with Cal Poly, and then our recommendations. For the background, the downtown visioning was a topic at the March 30th, 2009 joint meeting of the City Council and the Planning Commission. This was in anticipation of a redevelopment agency formation. We were directed to convene a subcommittee to prepare an outline compilation of available visioning documents. And then since then we've presented this presentation to the business forum, and we've incorporated the feedback into this presentation. The redevelopment agency was not approved. During that interim, council member Smuckler has developed a relationship with the City and Regional Planning Department at Cal Poly. The documents that we found and reviewed were the Downtown Embarcadero Specific Plan, the Morro Bay Coastal Land Use Plan, a study of Morro Bay's economic development opportunities, Destination 2000, Morro Bay Economic Vitality Plan, the Mini Urban Regional Design and Assistance Team Report, which was RUDAT, commonly known as RUDAT, City of Morro Bay Downtown Improvement Concepts, Vision 2020, and the Morro Bay Downtown Design Guidelines. The Downtown Embarcadero Specific Plan, which was done in 1978, this was developed by consultants with community input. This surveyed the downtown businesses. The findings were that the business people were aware of the two most pressing problems of downtown. Those are parking and visual appearance, and they're willing to deal with these problems. The majority wanted a visual and functional link to the Embarcadero, and at that time, 84% of the their clientele were local and were not tourists. The Morro Bay Coastal Land Use Plan, this was completed in 1982. The update for this plan is at the Coastal Commission now and has been for quite a while. This covers all of Morro Bay and is not specific to the downtown or the Embarcadero area. A study of Morro Bay's economic development opportunities. This was done in 1987. We were unable to find this document. The Destination 2000, completed in 1994. This document was developed by the City Council, by a City Council endorsed committee of diverse members. The goals were presented was to preserve natural resources and the overall environment, to enhance pedestrian facilities and market the natural resources of Morro Bay, maintain Morro Bay as a tourist destination. The Morro Bay Economic Vitality Plan, 1996. This plan was developed by the Chamber of Commerce and the Economic Vitality Committee with consultants. Their task was to create a plan to retain and attract business activity in order to create a stable tax base and stimulate economic vitality in Morro Bay. And the big question was what is Morro Bay's niche? The goals were to strengthen the business base, capitalize on our unique assets, the sea and the bay, and promote Morro Bay as a destination point. We come to RUDAT in 1997. This was developed via a four-day workshop by industry professionals with community involvement. The professionals were from both the AIA, local come from this document. Temporary parks. Some of the small-scale temporary parks were created. There's one next to Morro Bay Coffee, next to the Pizza Port, at the corner of Beach and Main, Beads by the Bay, and Top Dog Coffee, I believe, has one in progress. Streetscapes. The facade improvement grant program was initiated after RUDAT. It's no longer in process. Two blocks on Main and Morro were improved with lights and furniture. This program is stalled. The trees were not addressed. Design guidelines and standards were not developed. Enhanced gateways. The roundabout has been completed, and other gateways, need to be addressed. Pocket gardens was another example that they proposed. Coalesce Bookstore Gardens should be used as an example. Several opportunities now still exist on public and private properties to create temporary gardens. Street development, install pedestrian-friendly streetlights, create seasonal banners and ads, hang flower pots, create flower kiosks at sidewalks, create unified paving standards, create a pedestrian-friendly environment. The roundabout has been completed, and the improvements for this were paid for out of the city funds. The city center market, this plan was to develop Brannigan's into an open-air market like Pike's Place Market or the Ferry Building in San Francisco. There was also plans to stair-step the market down the bluff to create linkage with the Embarcadero. So this slide shows the vision that RUDAT was putting forth. It shows the Brannigan's Market with an area for outdoor entertainment, and the Centennial Stairway would be enhanced and incorporated to help incorporate the downtown section with the Embarcadero. The Morro Bay downtown improvement concepts, this was a local analysis of the RUDAT. Its recommendations were develop a seacoast nautical theme, start at Morro Bay Boulevard and Main and expand, develop streetscape concepts and standards, focus on material selection with an emphasis on natural and reclaimed materials, create an open space for special events. Vision 2020 was completed in 2005, and this was developed by a council-endorsed committee in order to update the Destination 2000. The goals were to define the character of Morro Bay for businesses, revitalize the old town, develop ecotourism, and preserve existing tourism, maintain a small town character, implement RUDAT, enhance pedestrian facilities, preserve the environment, link downtown with the Embarcadero, make downtown more inviting at night. The Morro Bay Downtown Design Guidelines. This was developed by an ad hoc committee of two planning commissioners, a downtown business owner, and two architects. I was one of the planning commissioners involved with that. The goals were to keep Morro Bay distinct, not have it turn into Anywhere USA, create and maintain pedestrian scale, protect natural resources and integrate a natural environment into design, create a form-based, not style-based codes. These guidelines were not adopted. When we're talking about form-based guidelines or codes, these are based on building elements, not on a particular style. It's not trying to create a Disneyland atmosphere. Almost any style can be incorporated into with these guidelines. The main goals are to improve the streetscape, define the acceptable material, form-based codes. This is another shot. This is the newly remodeled Weinman Building, and you can see the contrast between the Weinman Building and the Sports Authority, which has not been remodeled under these codes. You can also see the paving standards, where the paving standards, the new meet the old. By having these codes and guidelines, you create a consistent environment throughout the downtown area, and it doesn't create a cookie cutter approach either. The common themes for these documents that we found were definition and preservation of our unique setting, pedestrian and streetscape enhancements, linkage with other parts of town, the Embarcadero and North Main Street, to improve the economic vitality, create a funding source, and importance of diverse public involvement, establishment of design guidelines and standards. Now I'll turn the pointer over to John here, and he'll go on with the opportunity we have to partner with Cal Poly.
Thank you. So as our committee went over these documents, we realized that we had 30 years of good information that were developed over that time period with considerable public input and community support, but there was very little implementation. And one of those reasons was that you had all these documents but no plan for strategic implementation in a certain area. It was just good ideas, but never the one consolidating document that would get it done. And as was mentioned earlier, Council Member Smuckler had been discussing with the City and Regional Planning Department at Cal Poly some of the opportunities that may exist with them and their resource as a nationwide city and regional planning department that's highly reputable. And they suggested that they've had considerable success with their design studio that only happens in the spring quarter. And it's our choice of graduate students or undergraduate students. And after discussing it with Cal Poly, we believe that the graduate program is more appropriate. Unfortunately, they need a decision by December. They have a waiting list of communities that want to work with them. They have said that they would prioritize Morro Bay if we're able to make a decision by December and be in the queue for this spring quarter that's coming up. And what we would get is most likely teams of four, and there'd be three to four teams, and they'd work all quarter long with their professor on the quarter long project of developing a plan for the city. And I'll get into that in detail. And I want to make it very clear that they, before they got started, they would come to the city and the downtown business area and make sure that they were working on the preferred project. So just a little history of Cal Poly's experience. They've done this with many communities throughout the state. They've done the downtown specific planning for the city of Fresno, a strategic plan for the city of Delano. In San Francisco, they did a really interesting project on Indian Basin, which was the conversion of an old power plant on the bay. In Redding, they did a marina area specific plan. In Salinas, which has done an excellent job over the last few years redeveloping their downtown area, they did a Chinatown urban design plan. And in Oakland, which is the hard-to-see graphic here, they did a specific plan for their Otter Row. They had a very long street that was all run down and shut down car dealerships, and the city wanted to know what to do with that area, and they turned to Cal Poly for help. And these are the three proposals, all different proposals from these teams. And they develop a website for you, so you can go to the website, the community can go to the website and look at the entire plan, and then about four different beautiful posters talking about form-based codes and other implementation and visioning. Locally, they've worked quite a bit with San Luis Obispo for obvious reasons. They did the Avalo Ranch specific plan, the Monterey Street Uptown specific plan, which I'm going to get into detail on, and then worked with the city on smart growth solutions. They've done with small communities, Templeton Community Plan, Shandon Community Plan, San Miguel Community Plan, and then down in Arroyo Grande, the South County Government Area Concept Plan. So a lot of experience with big cities, big counties, and even in our county, quite a bit of partnerships. One that caught our eye that we wanted to share with everyone tonight was the Monterey Street Uptown Specific Plan. It's an interesting project. It basically goes from the county government center at Santa Rosa Street all the way up just past the train trestle almost to Apple Farm. And the city recognized that that's an area of town that's in conversion. It's auto dealerships, some gas stations that are going out of communities, and they emphasize working in a collaborative effort. They get all the stakeholders in place. This is a meeting on the Monterey Uptown street-specific plan, and they bring in the community, the city, property owners, city council members, everybody, to make sure that they're all focusing on those goals that were cited earlier. The proposal that Cal Poly would do for us is basically undertaking four tasks. Understanding the city's needs, and this came out of the Biz Forum meeting, that the downtown area really wants to define the culture, their challenges, opportunities, and their history. And we have, again, 30 years of documents for the students to review. We have their interest in meeting with the downtown businesses to get this project off on the right track. They'll review the documents, do some conceptual development, and then they'll actually put together a specific plan, not just one, but four specific plans. So each team will put one together and provide a draft downtown specific plan for us. And the contents of the specific plan, just to get into the details, there's an introduction, site inventory and analysis of all the existing uses, some case studies of what's worked and what hasn't worked in other communities and could work here. They will do the conceptual development of their visioning. They'll take land use circulation and public space evaluation. They'll do their conceptual design of the proposal area, and then they'll do the form-based codes, the urban form visual quality and massing, address what Jerry pointed out, or Commissioner Luer pointed out, the form-based approach to development. And then we've asked them to focus on implementation. That was a consistent theme with the history of the documents, that addressing funding, addressing how the community can get behind this and make this a reality, not just another document. So what we're going to get is one draft-specific plan per team. That's four total. And we talked about this with some consultants in the industry, and they said it's easily $150,000 plus for one specific plan to be developed. So we're getting four in this quarter project. And then there'd be a digital poster of each proposal. And the city of San Luis talked about how important it was for them to have posters to look to when they were making decisions, and just for the community to gain an understanding of the intent of the project. Presentations to the City Council and Planning Commission, and then a community event where they would come in with their posters and kiosks, and all the teams would be available to answer questions and meet with business owners and just interested residents about what was happening. And all this for less than $10,000. They've sent us a contract, and it's just a hair under $10,000. It's not going to salaries. It's strictly going to the students' time, cost, gas, not paying for pensions of Cal Poly professors or anything. So what are the benefits of the proposal? Well, we'll get a professional quality visioning document. And again, I want to emphasize it's not a senior project. We went to the website. It's on there. You can Google City and Regional Planning Cal Poly and look at these professional grade documents that these graduate students developed. And something not to overlook, but we'll develop a relationship with Cal Poly. They're very excited to work with Morro Bay. They said they'd put other cities behind in the queue if they're able to develop this relationship with us, and this could lead to other projects in other parts of the city. And then they're going to take a look at the big picture, not just offer incremental fixes, but actually provide the specific plan that will get us to where we want to go, where we have these 30 years of documents saying the same thing over and over again. They're going to take a look at that and then provide the path to get there. And something that came up in our discussions at the committee, but we're really excited about this helping, having a plan help with getting grants. There's state regulations that have come down focusing on smart growth, greenhouse gas reduction, AB 32, SB 375 come to mind, and we can have that be a focus of the Cal Poly program. Those bills are all about getting people out of their car, shopping, commuting, working by alternative transportation. And if we're able to have the specific plans of the downtown area address that, we'll be one step ahead of other communities when either funding sources come down that focus on these initiatives, or grants that already existed, their priority shifts to projects that help with greenhouse gas reduction. So I'm going to turn it over to Councilmember Smuckler, if he's still around, for our conclusion.
Thanks, John. You hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So if we are on the last slide, as John pointed out, and Jerry as well, the visioning documents that we reviewed span back 30-plus years. And I think the planning commissioners have done a good job of laying out the proposal. What we tonight would recommend is that our council direct staff to bring back funding options for us to discuss at the December 14th meeting. and a not to exceed capacity of $10,000, but also exploring some partial funding as well, if that's what members of the council would like. So we as a committee are still really excited about the opportunity that this presents. We're willing to continue to serve in this capacity with further direction from the rest of the council and the commission. And at this point, I think I'd like to turn it over to the council and also public comment to find out if there's anything else that we're missing.
Okay, any comments from either planning commissioners or council before we open it for the public comments? Start over on the planning commission side. Anybody?
Shall we start with Mr. Lucas?
Yes, just to add some information, my colleagues in the planning department have won national awards with these efforts before. These are just aren't school against school. These are planning, national planning organizations that recognize the quality of the work they've done and rewarded them with that kind of scrutiny for the quality of work. So I think it's great. We'll never find anything of this quality at that price. And I don't think we're compromising anything that our own department can do, and I think the public process that would be included with this. I'm personally extremely cautious to recommend form-based codes, but I think as long as it's in a public forum and discussed openly and honestly, I think that this is a wonderful thing to consider.
Gene.
Well, I think it was a very well done, thorough presentation, and you guys did a great job. Thanks. You know, obviously, the common themes were identified clearly over again, as was stated in the presentation. And in conclusion with that, the emphasis on implementation, you know, obviously 30 years of data, workshops, public input, and the opportunity to go forward with this, it is exciting. And with that added implementation emphasis, hopefully that would get us there. So thank you.
Either of you two have any more to say?
I'll wait to answer any questions.
Okie dokie. Shall we hand it over
questions
to you?
Questions over here, anyone? Rick?
Well, first of all, I'd just like to welcome Jeremy Irons to our bunch here. I think he's going to be a solid addition to the Planning Commission, and so welcome to you, Jeremy. And I guess I'm waiting for a comment from Mr. Rambo to see. He's been involved in this kind of stuff before, and he sees what's up here for this price, and I'd like to get his opinion of it.
I think it's a wonderful idea. All of these things are going in the direction, as the subcommittee's indicated, and that's been a clearly defined direction, so to speak. And I think it stirs a lot of inspiration and enthusiasm at a community level, and into all of this embraces where we've come from a policy and design standpoint, if you will. But one of the common pitfalls to these is translating all of those images into code and giving it some real bearing in policy, and then codifying it so that you really see it on the streets with new development. I'm pretty sure that didn't include, as you know, many of the plans that were referenced in their inventory didn't go to that implementation stage, and many have but are still caught in that whirlpool of getting certified, if you will, Coastal Commission, or getting the zoning ordinance codified, which, by the way, addressed many of those common things anyway, but is still waiting certification. So that's one of the things that many of those documents that you saw, that was the big stumbling block from getting to implementation. And I think that's still an issue. Not an issue. Matters on how much of an emphasis we place on it. But I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you that was what one of the common things of many of those plans were that didn't go forward. There's a lot of work in writing code and getting them, especially a form-based code. So if we want to give it teeth, it's going to take more than something like that. It gets at the hierarchy of some of these plans. There are visionary plans in the vertical hierarchy. There are expressions of interest. That's what this is, to get everybody kind of on the same page with what it should look like. Then the next, and that's then.
Not at this point.
Okay, then we'll open this to the public. That's a public hearing. So if you'd like to speak on the downtown visioning topic, please come forward. And seeing no stampede to the microphone, we'll bring it back. All right, so what we're looking for here then is a council decision to go ahead with this. Is that...
Well, I think what they've asked you this evening is if you're interested in moving ahead for staff to bring back, or for you to ask staff to bring back some idea of where the funding may come from. Okay. At your following meeting, I think they've got a December deadline.
Okay. I would like to make one comment, and that's that having been involved in a lot of the documents that you referenced, I think it's really important that, A, the people that are going to work on this understand the financial straits that Morro Bay is faced with continually. That doesn't seem to change. And so it's all very well and good to do something wonderful, but if we can't implement it financially, then it's not going to work. So we need to have them be very aware of that and perhaps scale back their dream of what it could be to a reality check of what we might actually be able to accomplish. Secondly, I would also, and I don't know where this comes in the process, but if we don't have buy-in from both the property owners and the store owners in the downtown area, this isn't going to go anywhere. What will happen is it will come to us as an idea, and it's going to be shouted down by one or the other because they didn't have input or whatever, and so again, it's going to get stalled. So those are the two stumbling blocks that I've seen happen before. So I guess what I'd like to see sooner rather than later is the involvement of the people who actually own the property down there and own businesses in the property down there. And I don't know how you do that, and I don't know if that's something that Cal Poly students would be doing, getting that buy-in and getting that support before developing their ideas as well as after. And I don't know, John or Jerry, can you respond to that at all? Do you know?
I'll take the first crack at that. There is a information gathering part of this proposal that that each of the teams would be required to do. We'd probably do this at a joint, have it as a joint meeting. Also, our committee, our subcommittee would be working as an outreach into the community. We've already gave the presentation at the Biz Forum. We're looking to meet with the Merchants Association and any other groups that are interested in talking to us to get the buy-in from the community. But as you know, it's easy for somebody to come, for somebody to stand up and yell no at any point in time, whether regardless of how much opportunity they've had on input. So that's always going to be a political reality, that if we want to see change happen, if we want to see things get better, that's going to need to be addressed. And they will do information gathering and community outreach at the beginning, and then they will also do a presentation to the community and to us at the conclusion. So, and then at that point, we will be able to take their ideas and incorporate their ideas into our plans. So, John?
And we were also challenged with the timing of our presentation to the Biz Forum and then continuing those discussions with the downtown merchants due to the holidays and schedules of our committee. But one of the reasons why we wanted to have your council act on this in December would give us the opportunity to do some additional outreach to the downtown merchants, because we agree 100% that this will take buy-in from them to be worthwhile, and believe that if you do approve the agendizing of this discussion for your meeting, we'll be able to do further outreach and engage those merchants more than we have. In our initial discussions, you know, they are organized, they are interested, they want to talk this out further and explore this opportunity because they are excited, recognize, just like in all the other planning documents, that something needs to happen and want to explore what that is.
How much importance do the property owners have versus the business owners? Because that seems to me, if we don't have property owner buy-in, facade improvements, all that stuff isn't going to happen, just like it didn't happen before when we actually had loans available for it. Nobody took advantage of it, or if they did, maybe one or two. So is that something that also will be explored, the actual property owners?
I think that's an important group that we have to reach out to and okay. and get their input on this, because they're going to be affected.
In finding where these property owners are and if they really care too much what's happening out in Morro Bay. That was, you know, an exception, I think, to what we've seen before.
Other council comments? Anybody? Carla?
Thank you very much for all the work that the three of you have done on that, and I certainly appreciate it. No, I sat on one of those committees years ago, as I'm sure other people here have too, and I am concerned. It's about the implementation of all these. It seems like we do a lot of studies and things, so I would hope that we'd have the opportunity to see some implementation. Something I found interesting is this last week, as you're talking about the downtown visioning, there's been a concern and an outpouring from several merchants that kind of tie into this with the farmers market and the possibility of it moving down to the Embarcadero versus the staying up in Old Town. And I'd hope maybe there'd be someone here tonight to speak during public comment about how that... to me, that's really a huge part of this. And when you look at RUDAT and all these other aspects of these collectively, those are the things, you know, having the farmers markets and things are part of what we're trying to implement. And now there's a consideration of moving it away. Not weighing in on it, but I hope anyone who is interested will have an opportunity to attend the meeting tomorrow night at Coles Bookstore and be part of that discussion, because I think it does have a huge bearing on the uptown area and the business it brings to that area. But I know there's still grant money available. Mayor Peters, you talked about the facade improvements and things that people didn't take advantage of, and that money's still there for those. So maybe, you know, doing something like this is what we need to kickstart that off again, getting this going. So... whenever everybody's done for discussion, I'm ready to move for a vote.
And I think that's 5:30 tomorrow at Coles.
Yes, it is.
Let me just ask before we make a motion. Noah, did you have anything else you wanted to say?
The only other thing I just wanted to underscore once again was, as a committee, we really did feel excited about the foundation of the historical documents, what they provide a community going back 30 years. But we also do not forget the need for a more up-to-date check-in with the community as the next important step, just to make sure that the community is still very much on the same page as they have seem to have been over the course of the last 30 years. And to give people the chance to comment, we found that at the business forum, there was a lot of really good feedback and interest, enthusiasm for this. And we just want to make sure that we interact with that in a respectful way that can help build buy-in and support for a plan that we can move forward with and feel proud of.
Okay. Would you like to make a motion, Noah?
May I make a comment, please?
Oh, yes, of course. I'm sorry.
I'd like to express appreciation for what Ms. Borchardt said about our street fairs, because that's something that has not been evident in our past documents, and that's certainly something that's very current for us. In addition, I think that this is a good step forward. All the comments I agree with so far, and I would like to see us move forward with it.
Okay. With that, Noah, would you like to make the motion?
Sure, I would. I would move that we direct staff to bring back options for funding the Cal Poly downtown spinning proposal at the December 14th council meeting.
Second.
And a not-to-exceed capacity of $10,000.
And that was seconded by Carla. Okay, any more discussion?
Yeah, I would. One more thing, Madam Mayor. I would see it easily, the money being appropriately coming from the sale of Brannigan's. which was purchased for the reason of connecting the two areas. And so I think that that's where the money could come from.
Well, that'll be part of the discussion. Yeah. Okay. All right. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. Oh, Noah, sorry.
Aye.
Did you vote in favor?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay, that takes care of that issue. And then our second item on the agenda is the California Environmental Quality Act CEQA workshop. And this is, I'm sorry. Oh, Noah, did you want to sign off or you want to stay on for the rest of the meeting?
At this point, if the remainder of the meeting is focused on CEQA, I will sign off.
Okay, well, there are the other discussions, but it's up to you. We got gray water systems, affordable housing, pedestrian plan, and reducing planning commission meetings. I don't suppose that one matters too much. How about the other three?
I'll stick on.
I'm sorry?
I'll stay with you.
Okay. All right. CEQA's up next. And who's doing this, Kathleen or Bruce?
I can introduce it a little bit, Mayor Peters. Kathleen's going to go through the presentation. And as we, because she works, the planners work with us on a daily basis. But
I hope I'm not going to bore you. So we're going to start off with just some basic CEQA basics. How's that? And we want to give you a little bit overview. We're going to go through an outline of the origins of CEQA, the rules, the process, and just some major issues and concepts. And I think this always kind of surprises everybody that in 1969 it was President Nixon who signed NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. And in 1970, Governor Reagan signs CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, the statute established by the legislature. Okay? The statute continued to be modified by the legislature and to be interpreted by the courts. So it was originally intended to apply to public projects only. And there was a court case in 1972, the Friends of Mammoth versus Board of Supervisors, that changed that and had CEQA apply to all projects subject to discretionary action. So the purpose of CEQA is to seek ways to avoid or minimize environmental damage, generally protect the environment through mitigation measures and alternatives. It is foremost a public disclosure document. It informs decision makers about the environmental consequences of their actions and discloses to the public why decisions are made. When we're utilizing CEQA, we use these three different sources: the statute, which is found under Public Resource Code 21,000 to 21,178, the guidelines, which is the California Code of Regulations Title 14, and the course, which is case law. And so those three things are invaluable resources to us doing CEQA work. The guidelines we use quite often, and they're a roadmap for implementing CEQA and intended to be certified and adopted every 2 years and are recognized by courts but do not carry the same weight as the statute. You might know or remember that in your work program for the planning staff, we have updating of our own City of Morro Bay CEQA guidelines. The Office of Planning and Research is another tool that we use, and they're online, and they're responsible for the content of guidelines. Categorical exemptions operates the State Clearinghouse. That's where our environmental documents are sent up to for distribution, and maintains internet information on CEQA, but does not enforce CEQA. In one of the first things that in working with CEQA is we define the agencies. There's lead agencies, responsible agencies, trustees agency, and federal agencies. We are, as the City of Morro Bay, often and most are always the lead agency, and so we're preparing the CEQA documents. And often, and we, as we can, we contract out to a consultant. That would be for the more complex CEQA documents like EIRs, et cetera. We coordinate with public and other agencies, modify project to minimize negative impacts and prepare findings and mitigations. We're also responsible for coordinating the following parties: the applicants, the consultants, citizens and organizations, agencies with jurisdiction by law, which is called a trustee agency, and possibly, if everything were to go wrong, the courts. The legislature finds that and declares that it is the policy of the state that public agencies should not approve projects as proposed if there are feasible alternatives or feasible mitigation measures available which would substantially lessen the significant environmental effects of such projects. This is hard to read. We've given you a large copy of this, and this is the typical CEQA flow chart. And this is important just as a visualization because it gives people the idea that it's a decision tree. And so when you first start off, the first thing that we're going to talk about is it a project under CEQA? And you follow these lines down, and it takes the planner who's doing this sort of using the flow chart to where that the sum total of environmental documents that are going to be necessary for this project. So we talk about we have the phases of what we go through, and one is the preliminary review. Okay, so one of the first things we do is we talk about, is it a project? And a project is an activity which may cause either a direct physical change in the environment or a reasonable foreseeable indirect physical change in the environment, and which is any of the following: an activity directly undertaken by a public agency, an activity undertaken by a person which is supported in whole or part through contract, grants, subsidies, loans, or other forms of assistance from one or more public agencies, and an activity that involves the issuance to a person of a lease, permit, license, certificate, or other entitlement for use by one or more of a public agency. So once we've gone back, and I'm going to back up here and probably confuse you, but we go back to the decision tree here. So once we've, so it's generally speaking, it's pretty inclusive a project. You would find it rare to come up with stuff, as I'm having right now, and Bruce's too. But I would say anything ministerial would be a good example.
Thanks.
And then you have the statutorial exemptions, which would be the next one, and they're kind of similar to the project exemption that we just talked about. They're feasibility and planning studies, ministerial projects, absence of discretion, emergency projects, projects that are rejected, specific projects identified by the legislature. And that gets into really strange stuff like the Olympics, you know, things that they know that are just so huge. I mean, you can find things in the statutorial exemptions that we know intuitively would have environmental impacts, but there'd be no way we'd ever have the Olympics come here if they had to mitigate the environmental impacts. So they stick them under the statutorial exemption category. So that's kind of a catch-all of a lot of miscellaneous, sometimes certain public projects you might find underneath there. And then we go on to, if it's not one of those and we research those out, then we're going to look at the categorical exemptions. This is the one we commonly use. And we just gave you a few examples up here of what's a categorical exemption, which would be existing facilities, replacement or construction, new construction or conversion of small structures, your typical single-family home. Most of the small exemptions have size limitations to them or location limitations. So like the, let's say, for example, I think the new construction or conversion of small structures is limited to four or less under 10,000 square feet. So, you know, it's relatively restricted. And all of these exemptions are always governed under the rule that that it's assuming that where you find this project is not environmentally sensitive. So in the city of Morro Bay, we're always researching our maps and things that aid us in determining when something is located in an environmentally sensitive area, which may be, in this particular community, an ARC site, you know, archaeological site. We have maps that we keep at the office that indicate where these are. The zoning ordinance has specific guidelines from those locations that are already mapped, and when they fall within a certain number of feet to a map site, then it requires additional environmental review, and we would not use one of these categorical exemptions in that situation.
Would another example be one of the many creeks that goes through Morro Bay?
Oh yes, if the piece of property was designated as we've had a project going before us, it's on Eshland, that would be similar. It's noted, it's mapped, it's noted in an official document as being an environmentally sensitive piece of property, yes. Okay, so we've sort of done the preliminary review of CEQA, and we use those in most often the categorical exemptions. We use those quite often for small projects here in the community. And now we're going to get into the more complex review, and we're going to be talking about the preparation of an initial study, and we find that that's the trigger that comes down when you can't find, you know it's a project and you can't find an exemption for it, you're going to do an initial study. And this slide right here just shows if we do an initial study and it's a typical checklist that's provided, most communities use the one provided by the state, and it's a typical from community to community, they're pretty similar. And if you come up with all the checklists and you come up with no impacts, you're going to follow that tree down, and you're going to do a negative declaration. That could happen, and often does, or could, in a situation where you couldn't find a categorical exemption, but that fit the specific project, but it just isn't going to have any impacts. But more often than not, after doing an initial study, and particularly in Morro Bay, we're going to find that it has significant impact of one or another. It could be pretty typical would be the arc issue, or maybe possibly if something's out on the water, it's going to be an eelgrass issue that we're going to be pretty typical and find those. So once we've done that, we've identified some area that has an impact, we're going to create what's called a mitigated neg deck. And the difference between the negative and the mitigated is there are impacts that need to be mitigated, and so that's the, so in this case, the negative declaration is actually the positive thing to have. And so, and then in the middle category on this slide, it talks about if you prepared an initial study because you're working under a previously approved master EIR, which I think for our conversations, we're just going to kind of bypass that because it gets into a little bit more complex of, yeah.
Potential for a significant impact. And so when the determination is made, it's not significant. It's not a determination. It means there's a potential for a significant impact. And then that potential can be mitigated through a mitigated negative declaration. When it has been determined that there is a potential significant impact or there is a significant impact, then we go on the other route, which is EIR. And then there's a whole series of things that happen with the environmental impact report. Yes, sir.
So would it be correct to assume that an EIR is good for 5 years?
Well, as a rule of thumb, yes. But we would look at it and see if there's anything that's changed. Normally it is, but if a new road comes in or if something changes or new standards are adopted, I mean, we have to look at a number of things, but it's kind of as a rule of thumb. And that's referring to a master environmental impact report, and we don't have any of those. So didn't want to complicate things, but and furthermore, we don't do many environmental impact reports in this community. The last time we did one was actually State Park Marina, but before then, I think it was in the 80s.
Could you clarify a statement you made as saying we would ask for a new one? When you say we ask, are you asking the applicant? Or are you asking, who do you ask?
The applicant.
The applicant. And so they can refuse it?
Well, then it's deemed incomplete. And we can't even recommend it. Then it's deemed incomplete. Mm-hmm. And we can't complete the project. They need to provide that information so that we can move them forward.
Thanks.
Okay, so I'm back to this. We do the initial study checklist, which I indicated before is about 70 questions. It has stayed pretty consistent, the checklist. I think we'll see some changes in it coming down soon regarding greenhouse gas, those types of things. And that's one of the things we see coming, I think, in the next year, altering the checklist. And just reiterating what we already said, if there's no significant impacts, it's a negative DAC. If there are and they can be mitigated, then it's a mitigated neg DAC. We circulate they use ND commonly to refer to both of them because they're a neg DAC, they're not an EIR. So it circulates to SNCDAC. An initial study and the review period is between 20 and 30 days. In this community, it is always 30 days because we have an agency that we have to circulate to, which is the Coastal Commission. So that's part of the regulations. In some communities, they can do 20 days. So we do that when there's no significant impacts, and if there are, they've been mitigated to a less than significant level. And where there are significant impacts and they can't be mitigated to a less significant level, then we're going to prepare an EIR.
Sorry.
Go ahead. That
idea about less than significant level, who determines what's significant?
Well, let's just jump forward a little bit, okay? So in we're going to tools for determining significant effect we use the CEQA guidelines, the mandatory findings is significant, the Appendix G in CEQA, any adopted thresholds. The city can always adopt their own thresholds pursuant to Section 15064.7, and any other agency adopted standards. So the city itself could have thresholds for significance if it chose to adopt them.
So staff makes a recommendation of what they think significant based on these documents. And then does that have to be approved by the Planning Commission, or is it because you say it, then it's so?
No, it's not. No, it doesn't work that way. We're always staff, and we're making a recommendation. And so we use these documents, and although the City of Morro Bay might not have adopted thresholds, we also do standards and, you know, common practice. In other words, you know, you build up a sort of history with how other projects have been looked at. But that becomes part of a document that it's goes forward to either Planning Commission or City Council for adoption. And either one of the decision-making bodies, depending on what the level of the project is, I'm assuming if it's going with an EIR, it's probably going all the way up to City Council. That's for you to make it's just a recommendation on staff's part.
Right. I just want to add to what Kathleen said. So if the Planning Commission or Council disagrees with that determination, that's entirely your prerogative, and that's why it's coming to you to say whether or not you agree or disagree. And that's the time to say, well, we think this is significant. We don't really have thresholds of significance because we're mostly a built-out community, places where they're experiencing growth problems do normally have thresholds of
what I spoke to before, but also we are using experts and utilizing their studies that are presented with the application. And you want to go back? Okay. Oh, sorry. Okay. So when we determine that there are significant impacts and that it needs to prepare an EIR, that's an
potential.
Yeah, right, potential. Then we're going to first establish the scope of the EIR and do a preliminary project review and conduct a scoping meeting. And see my little typo up there? I think that should be not always required, but it's pretty common that we have a scoping meeting, invite people to come and, you know, give their input as to what they think should be in the EIR. And then we're going to issue a notice of preparation, and we're going to use the initial study, the NOP, and comments to finalize the scope of the EIR. So scoping meeting is usually sort of the public meeting that where they can have input. From there, usually there's a consultant and engaged, and they're going to do a draft EIR, and they're going to prepare an administrative or screen check the EIR for an internal review. That's not usually published for the public to review. It's an administrative review, and there are lots of reasons why that doesn't go out, but as you can see, sometimes it's just a matter of checking for typos and making sure everything's correct before, as we do as staff, before we give a public review document. So then a draft EIR is prepared, and that goes out for official distribution, and that is circulated with the notice of completion for 30 to 45 days. And during that process, we collect all kinds of comments for the EIR, and we hold a hearing on the adequacy of the EIR. And the final EIR, which I'm sure you've seen them before, the draft EIR is usually the large, thick document, and the final is usually the thinner document, has in it the responses to comments. And once that's any letter that's received or a comment, then there's a response generated for that. And then you circulate that to those who've commented or the entire final EIR for 10 days. You hold hearing on the final EIR and certify the EIR before taking action on the project.
Another interjection, because we've had lots of discussions about public comment and input. So these notices of completion and the collecting the comments and holding hearings, there's a minimum notice that CEQA requires or not, or how do you decide that?
There's a 45. The draft needs to be on the streets or available for public review for a minimum of 45 days.
And how do people know that it's available?
We send out the notice of availability to the list that, for example, the treatment plan has probably 50 different individuals and entities. All those state agencies, local agencies, persons who expressed interest in it, any body that is on that list. That attended the scoping meeting, for example, and for example, the treatment plan. Anybody that's on there is caught in our kind of communication net. So there's no limitation on who can comment on it. Mm-hmm. So there is a minimum period of time it needs to be available for public review, and then we will hold a hearing to solicit formal comment. I mean, any comment made is a formal comment within that period, and we respond to it.
Whether it's oral or written?
That's correct. And then we will go to the next step and respond to the people that provided that feedback to us, and that needs to be done within 10 days. And then with the formal response, and then incorporate all those comments into the final. So our draft isn't even out for review yet. We've had quite a bit of feedback on it so far, but as soon as it comes out, that's when we really expect people to see what's being proposed, not just an idea of one. We're actually going to provide the analysis so they can hopefully read the document and see in detail what impacts there may or may not be.
Okay, and when you take make final approval of the project, you're going to adopt a statement of findings and fact, statement of overriding consideration, and then it's mitigation monitoring program, which is finally known as the MMP. And so we talked about determining significant impacts, and it's these are the general rules on it, that it's substantial or potentially substantial adverse change in physical conditions, including land, air, water, minerals, flora, fauna, ambient noise, or objects of historic or aesthetic significance. Social and economic change by itself shall not be considered a significant effect on the environment.
Meets the greater good for everybody. And if you remember at the beginning of this presentation, CEQA is mostly a public disclosure document, too. It's an analytical tool, but most importantly, it's a public disclosure document so that folks can be informed and involved and participate in that process. So that's a good example of a statement of overriding considerations.
Let me just add to that the way CEQA works, a lot of people get confused with overriding considerations. They think that makes it so that the project doesn't have to do any mitigations, and that's not true. What happens is a statement of overriding consideration is used when the project can't mitigate all its impacts down to a level of less than significant. And so there, the project would still have to mitigate to the maximum possible. And then the gap between what it can do and what it can't do is where the overriding considerations. And like I said, a lot of people thought that was sort of like a get-out-of-jail-free card, so you're not doing mitigations, and that's not an accurate statement. And so going on with what is substantial evidence, it includes facts, reasonable assumptions based on facts, expert opinion based on facts, does not include argument, speculation, unsubstantiated opinion, erroneous information. So we went through this, and we talked about determining significant effect, and we're kind of
throwing a bunch of stuff out here, which is very much a lot of jargon, but we're getting into mandatory findings. The lead agency shall find a project may have a significant effect if certain effects occur. Okay. Consider significance after mitigation in making this finding. So those are one of the things that you have to do is make the findings. And one area that also gets a little bit confusing as far as projects is a project can have less than significant impacts individually, but cumulatively may result in something that has a potential significant impact. And this is just another element of CEQA that we have to look at, and it's the very end of the checklist. It talks about after you've gone through the project specifics, there's a section that talks about cumulative. And so you can have incremental impacts of a project when added to other closely related past or present or reasonably foreseeable projects that end up being significant. Effects that are individually limited but cumulatively considerable. An EIR analysis must identify related projects through like a list. I'm sure maybe in a community this small that doesn't quite happen. We're not moving at that kind of fast pace, but an example of this would be where you have an impacted traffic intersection and, you know, individually the guy's just putting a few more, trips per day on it, but cumulatively those trips per day then result in a level of service that exceeds what your general plan will allow you to have. So that's sort of like the one drop in the glass kind of analysis. So this is the last thing we do on the checklist. And it says not cumulative considerable if a project's contribution is substantially reduced or a project would comply with a mitigation program that reduces it to a level of less than significant. And so we just provide for you a definition of baseline, and that again gets baseline is what we were talking about previously about determining thresholds. And you know, it's critical because it's just a set of environmental conditions and gets once the project is compared to determine if a significant impact would occur. And so, you know, we set the baseline. This last statement here is normally the baseline is set at the time of the issuance of note of preparation. And I think that's just important to note that sometimes projects in every community take an exceedingly long time to get done, and an applicant has a reasonable expectation that they can have their baseline established when they first start.
And if I can add to that, for example, our treatment plant currently has is rated for a higher capacity. The new treatment plant is less of a capacity. The treatment product effluent is of a higher degree, is of a higher quality than when we're currently than our current effluent stream, So our baseline here with the project is, from an environmental standpoint, is more environmentally benign because we have less flows and we're providing a better effluent. So that's why I'm bringing that to bear with the discussion of baseline. So from here on, all of the analysis, when folks are saying, well, this is significant, well, this is our baseline, just the plant in operation today.
I have an example from the county. When they were putting the cell tower up on 41, before he asked for a permit, the man went in and graded. And then he asked for his permit. So was the baseline when he graded or before he graded? And I think he got penalized for grading ahead of time before the permit because he changed the baseline. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I think sometimes with CEQA that there's other elements of CEQA that you can't you know, they want to look at a cumulative project. You can't segment it apart. You know, it prohibits you from doing that. It sounds like that's what the gentleman tried to do. Break it up. LinkedIn is so dynamic, right? Not right today in this economy, but it has been in the past. So we get down to the baselines, and we're just talking about, you know, this slide just explains that there are exceptions and differences depending on circumstances. So, and let's see, little slide here that gives a little overview of decision whether to prepare EIR and the fair argument standard, which is commonly part of the CEQA analysis. And you need to ask the question whether it's required, and it's the EIR is required if a fair argument exists that a project may have a significant effect on the environment. It must be backed by a substantial evidence, this argument. And this is kind of gets into the
how we use CEQA, and it's not generally does not matter how much evidence supports the opposite conclusion of less than significant. So it's just it errs on the side of those who think that there are significant environment or significant effects or impacts to the environment of the project. So that's when it's talking about the fair argument, and the fair argument gets into what a reasonable person would see if they read the evidence in the record. And so moving on, we're talking about mitigation measures and what they're intended to do, avoid the impact, minimize the impact, restore, repair the harm, reduce the impact over time, or compensate for the harm. And mitigation is required for things that are significant. Generally on the checklist, where once a mitigation is put into an initial study, if we're going to go into a mitigating neg deck, we check the box less than significant with mitigations. And so
when you list these measures, are these in order on purpose? Like, do you have to first avoid the impact before you minimize it?
No, they're just a list of, I mean, a person could avoid, if they could avoid the impact, of course, I'd be the I think any applicants trying to do that, get their project forward. But no, they're just different options of how you could actually minimize an impact. Just a minute.
Yeah, but I think if, for example, the Planning Commission or the Council disagrees and they think avoidance is the preferred approach to it, then you can give them that direction, or you cannot agree and make that determination, and then provide the feedback to them, and then we'll tell them they'll hear what you feel is necessary. Mm-hmm. So it's not etched in stone. These are guidelines, and the state guidelines applied locally throughout every jurisdiction, and everybody deals with the same framework, but as Kathleen indicated, we have different levels of significance, different circumstances.
And with all state laws, we can make them more restrictive if we want, but we can't make them less than?
If you feel it's having a significant impact, yes, you can. We're only getting into mitigations where it is significant. So some folks may feel that this project is significant, and that's your prerogative. And then you've got to deal with the rule of reason. And if the evidence in the record supports that conclusion, then it does.
Kathleen, is this the section where they look at alternate projects as well, or where does that come up?
Well, that's under the EIR, and I think I've kind of blended this through to trying to get, you know, this 101 lesson not to be extremely boring or lengthy. But is it coming up? Okay. So here, what we're going to look for, I mean, mitigation measures work both in the mitigated neg deck, and you would also have them in your EIR. So it's kind of a dual thing we're going over right now. And I think that we find that often you can't meet, it's not possible to avoid the impact. For instance, in our community here, someone who wants to do something on the Embarcadero, who's going to put something over a walkway or something over the water, we're not going to tell them not to do something to enjoy our wonderful water view. So we're going to minimize the impact by having mitigations, such as I've seen since I've been here, dealing with the ill grass and things like that. And they seem to work well. Lots of times, just minimizing it, reducing the impact, and sometimes compensating or repair. Like in, for instance, a typical one would be to replant ill grass. And usually, I think the standard here is 2-1. So you know, it's kind of typical of what we see. Avoiding the impact might be a little bit more complex, and maybe something that you'd find more in an EIR, where you're just going to tell somebody, you just can't do that. Put your project somewhere else. So back to the mitigation measures, we try to make them action, you shall. They're not considered. It's very important that the mitigation agency can choose whether it wants to do what they call monitor the mitigation, report on the mitigation, or both. A report consists of written compliance review, and monitoring is a periodic process of project oversight. I see a lot in the mitigation since I've been here of
mitigations are written prior to issuance of this or prior to certificate of occupancy, the agency shall ensure that the applicant has performed something. So often they're asked to either, you know, verify this or submit a study for that or what it is, and we make sure that those are all getting taken care of and compliance with the environmental document. So this is an ongoing thing usually until the project's complete. And so it's just noted that reporting is appropriate when mitigations are readily measurable, and monitoring is appropriate when mitigations are more complex, such as wetland restoration. And that might occur in this community. Monitoring might occur, like if you had somebody who did some eelgrass replanting, you want to make sure that those things are taking and growing, you know, so it's kind of a long-term issue there. And reporting is more typically what we see when somebody says, like for instance, I just received one today on a house that had a mitigation for ARC, and the archaeologist that was in site during when the project was being built just completed his report and sent it in. So that becomes part of the environmental record. And we make sure that if anybody came in and reviewed the record, that we would have that as part being part of the checked off mitigation monitoring program. And so, as I said before, the program needs to have responsibility of who's doing what, and the project and responsibilities of the project proponent. It usually has very specific timings and triggers, and general standards for determining the project's compliance with the mitigation. It also is to contain enforcement procedures for noncompliance, including provisions for administrative appeals. And so now we're going to get into the EIR selective of alternatives, and that would be something, you know, more specific to EIRs, and it's just indicating that alternatives must be feasible, they must reasonably attain the basic objectives of the project, and they need to focus on alternatives capable of lessening the significant impacts of the project.
So if I can add to that, and there's been some discussion, for example, on the environmental impact report and the analysis of alternatives for the treatment plant. What we're using to focus this on is what are the significant impacts we're having? And right now, we're not mitigating any because we're not having any significant impact. So any of the alternatives from the new treatment plant is generally our feeling is that it's, you know, a form of mitigation anyway. But what the burden is really, if you have a significant impact, then you need to look at alternatives that reduce, eliminate, or avoid, or eliminate, or lessen that impact. So our baseline is different than, say, for example, a new project where they're proposing something that didn't exist. So that's a little background on how we gauge the analysis of alternatives. And as you know, we've indicated what those alternatives would have been in the treatment plan. Some of them are required, for example, the no project alternative. And then you look at a reasonable range of alternatives. One of the ones that came up for the treatment plant was the Chorro Valley alternative. So we studied that, at the city did, not the CSD. So anyway, just hope that helps you when you're moving along.
Excuse me, Bruce. With the new environmental laws that are coming by us, SB 375 and such, are they going to be requiring embedded energy calculations on projects?
I gave our consultant that's working on our environmental impact report, and they have a team that does just greenhouse gas analysis, and they've got the guidelines that that the APCD has produced for our county. And I asked them over that. They said there weren't any conflicts or anything at all. And so in answer to your question, we are in total compliance with what the draft standards are that are being recommended by APCD right now. So that's when it comes out, we've been aware of where they're at, and we should be tracking right with them.
How do you know when you have to do a no project alternative? Who tells you that?
It's required.
Yes.
Yes. Is it always required?
Yes. Yeah, and as it is to accomplish the basic objectives of the project. Mm-hmm. There's the basic objectives, that's required, and then there's the no project alternatives required.
One of the good things about working with applicants when you're doing an EIR is working with the alternatives. We have a project that will be coming before
Planning Commission soon. That was the marina dredging project, and they had in their EIR alternatives, which now the project has modified itself a little bit, and it actually complies with one of the alternatives. So it's really great when you work with people and you get substantially reduced, supported by substantial evidence in the record. Reasons can be economic, legal, social, technological. I'm sure everybody's familiar with that. And then finally, we just give you some potential weaknesses for environmental documents in that, you know, it didn't have an adequate definition of the project or exemption, failure to prepare an EIR or the adequacy of an EIR, or failure to follow a procedure. And that concludes it. I apologize if it was kind of jumping. I know it's a lot of information all at once.
How can you be inadequate if we're preparing it?
Well, I think
we're not saying it's inadequate. We wouldn't put it out if we didn't think it was adequate. Mm-hmm.
But someone would challenge it then.
Right.
Okay. So we didn't need an EIR on our dredging, did we? And is that because we've done it before and it's been done in the past 5 years?
Well, the dredging is done by the Corps, and right. they did the environmental documentation under federal laws, so they did the NEPA documentation, which is kind of like the CEQA equivalent.
So if we're able to piggyback them on the back marina dredging, will we still have to do an EIR if we use the same company, or if we use a different company, we'll have to do?
No. It doesn't matter on what company it is. I think it's more of a timing thing, but this is not part of their project. The Corps is doing their project, and we'd be kind of coming right behind them with this project, and so it's two different things, really. And we're hoping, in terms of timing, to do it quickly enough so that we could take the advantage of using the same contractor, but it's a different jurisdiction. The federal government doesn't need to get anything from us if they don't want.
Any other questions from council? Noah, are you still there?
I am. My only question, and Ruth spoke to it earlier, in regards to other standards like those that are supplied by a group like the Air Pollution Control District, I just wanted to hear a little more elaborate on that. And in particular, I'm curious about, sea level rise, about that, if the CEQA project or a project that was formally approved but now might have to deal with that sort of consideration?
I believe we are going to have some analysis of sea level rise. All I can tell you at this point is that our consultant has the guidelines for preparing environmental documents and doing the air quality analysis, and they've confirmed that we're consistent with it. So from an analytical standpoint, we'll be looking at greenhouse gases from an apples-to-apples comparison. I don't know what the results are from the sea level question, but that's the purpose of the environmental document, to disclose that. And if anybody has any comments, they can certainly make them, and we'll respond to them. If what's in the document is in any way inadequate, we'll change it.
Any other questions from council? Nancy? Anybody
down here?
Whoops. Anybody down here? You guys satisfied? Yes, sir.
Thank you. I know that's very confusing territory, and having read the EIR for the marina round one, it's not fascinating reading, but it is an important reading. I guess my one comment is, if I wanted to find out about a lot of the conditions that my property might have, a lot of these are public sources, and there's other aspects of information that's out there where I would be aware of what I was getting into when I purchased a property. I guess my biggest conundrum has always been the cultural resource issue, because you could theoretically purchase a project, purchase a property, feel like you have a modest addition. I remember that project we were just speaking about with the underground garage on Main Street. You know, because they were going to such an extent of excavation, and because they were in one of the archaeological coverage zones, A lot of people would enter into an agreement, perhaps, to take a project forward without knowing they were going to be entering into these kinds of zones. So with the cultural resources, there's not a disclosure thing up front when you buy a property like there is for some of the other things that are natural around here. I think I remember my own property having things like pesticide sprays for the farms and earthquake zone, you know, Diablo Canyon, things like that. So I always wonder in there between disclosure and confidentiality where some of these things, could someone come to the counter and ask, is this property that I'm considering in a cultural resource zone?
I suppose that they could ask staff and we could check on our maps, but that's one input.
In response to Councilmember Smuckler's question about if you have input, we'll take it, and I think he was talking about seawater rise, but technically comments can only be considered during the notice of preparation and the scoping meeting. Are you doing this at a courtesy or?
No. The notice of prep is required, and we took the comments of the scoping. But the analysis will occur, is being conducted now, and what comes out will be the draft document. So that's when it's not a moving target. We're preparing the environmental document, you know, so there's a remote possibility folks may be satisfied with the answer that we've provided in our analysis in the draft document. And I don't think it's remote. It's our expectation that it is an adequate answer. So,
but I guess my question is, the notice of preparation provides notice for agencies or individuals to comment on the project and provide input. And once that comment period closes, the agency is not required to take comments anymore. And we're in that window right now where you don't have to take comments as you develop the draft EIR. Am I correct?
Not really. Well, yes, you are. But what I can tell you, our administrative practice is, if there is anything that's changing the direction of the analysis and the report, but at this point, there's nothing significant that we're mitigating. We haven't identified any significant impacts. We don't have any. The new plant is less impacting than our existing plant, which has no impacts. So we're not even getting in the discussion of significant reducing or eliminating or avoiding significant impacts because we're not having any to begin with. It would be different if we were. So, you know, that's what may perhaps change the scope of the analysis, but that's at a scoping level. We're at the point now where we're conducting the analysis and the draft will be released. Then it's not a moving target.
To make that comment that the current plant has no significant impacts, is that because there was no EIR done on the plant when it was first built because it was pre-CEQA?
Well, thankfully, we've got over 20 years of intensive surf zone and shoreline monitoring, and we provide those reports on a quarterly basis. So we're able to say from the position of fact that we're not having an impact on the receiving waters. Furthermore, we're able to say that the capacity of this plant is lower. The new plant's capacity will be lower than the existing plant capacity.
Anything else?
Yeah. I'm not sure how this fits into CEQA, but on the seawater rise, what is the threshold of effect where it impacts a project, and what projects are affected by that? I know there's a new standard coming out of seawater rise that has to be included in the impact of projects. So
we will look at that in the document. We will. We did flooding. Part of that is shoreline surf zone run up too. We will look at the impact of sea level rise.
I'm more concerned on other projects too, because any project on the Embarcadero may be caught in this threshold. So what is the threshold now, and or in the future, what are they going to be looking at? What's the Coastal Commission going to require?
Well, I'm not quite sure what they're going to do, what the Coastal Commission is going to do. I don't really know where they're headed to with it. I'm relying on our environmental consultants, and ESA does these all up and down the state, so they're very conversant with that question, and I'll kind of yield to whatever their recommendation is.
Okay. That it? All right. I think we're finished with that topic. I'm assuming that we might want a short break before we continue on the rest. Is that agreeable to everyone? Okay. We'll take a quick break. Thanks for hanging in. Oh, that cold. Wait, let me know. Okay, we're back. And I think the next topics were all brought up by the Planning Commission. So, Nancy, I'm going to let you handle those.
Okay, gentlemen, let's start with item number 3, considering reducing Planning Commissions to once a month. I think what we want to do is just go around and get some input from planning commissioners. How does that sound like a place to start? Michael Lucas, can we start with you?
Well, I think this came because of consent
staff to bring projects for us to move forward. So, you know, if it is slow, I guess the decision or the conversation could lead to the possibility of going to once a month, or could we be productive with that second meeting through other projects?
Okay. John Diodati?
Thank you. I sent the email that asked to have this on the agenda, and really my intentions were to bring this issue to the City Council's attention. We've come into a slowdown. All cities are experiencing this slowdown. And just for the last few months, we've had very light agendas. The one meeting lasted 14 minutes, and it just seemed ridiculous that we had AGP staff and ourselves there basically just to go through the motions of the first few items on the agenda, which were the Pledge of Allegiance and reviewing the minutes. So I agree with the other two commissioners. We signed up for this to meet twice a month, and none of us want to cut back to once a month, but the reality is it's slow, and we're not doing much. And I wanted to have the commissioners discuss this and then City Council discuss if it's prudent to realize possibly a cost savings and cut back to once a month until projects pick back up, or alternatively recognize that we're slow and use us as a resource to get through some issues that the council wants to see accomplished in this slow time.
Thank you. Jerry Luer.
Yeah, I would concur with with the other comments, and I think this. Think if we could create a quicker or more expedited method of canceling meetings if something does come up, like I think our shortened meeting was because they requested a continuance at a late date. So once again, it brings staff out in the evening, you know, for extra time, and they could be using their time better. I along with the other commissioners would like, if we've got a slow time, maybe we can schedule in some of the future work items or some of the other pressing problems with the community. But when we have a change of circumstances, if there can be an expedited method of canceling a meeting, I think that would be appropriate.
Thank you. I think our infamous meeting of 12 minutes and 10 seconds was because someone had to request a continuance based on another agency, I think a state agency, not having the information they needed in time. And because it had been continued to a specific date, we had to meet. That was an unfortunate experience that I hope will not happen again. I think part of our I would hate to see us go officially to once a month, because there are a lot of these continued items sitting out there just kind of waiting, you know, for us. I can think of at least 3 at the moment where they're waiting for other agencies, and these are are people who are anxious to get their projects through, and there are projects there. But also, I don't like to come here and do 10-minute or 12-minute meetings. It doesn't seem practical. And if we could, as Mr. Luer said, have a way to cancel in a satisfactory amount of time. I know traditionally, having been on the commission probably longer than most of these guys, we generally have things available to us by Wednesday afternoon. And I think that's within the time frame that it can be canceled without putting people out of, the community I'm thinking of right now, that gives them time, you know, to realize that something's not going to happen if we know by Wednesday afternoon. So that would be kind of my suggestion, you know, if there's not anything by noon or 2 o'clock Wednesday, if it's not ready, we cancel the meeting, if that works. Maybe we need to be careful about continuing to a date specific, because, you know, we can't control what other agencies are doing or when. I'd like to get some staff input on this question, if that's appropriate.
That's where I was going to go next. What's your response on
that? I think that's a great idea. Because, you know, in the development review process, folks just sometimes aren't ready to go, even though they'll tell us they're ready to go. But if they don't come in and have what you need to review their proposal, then, you know, we don't have it. We can set deadlines. The meeting procedure, the formal procedure that you have for canceling a meeting, is that it has to be on the meeting.
Carla?
I have a question. I guess I'm still a little confused. What is the, and I don't know if it's Bruce or Andrea, the cancellation maximum, Wednesday, Thursday, that you can cancel it? What's the last day?
In our policy manual, we have that it has to be noticed at a meeting previous to cancel a meeting. So you'll see on, say, the December Recreation and Parks Commission, they have cancellation of the January meeting. So it makes it almost impossible for a planning meeting to be canceled at the last minute, the way it's set up now. We do have some amendments to make to that policy manual, so if there is a decision tonight to change that, we've got to bring back that policy manual anyway to the council for some other amendments that you've done.
So it's just strictly based on the policy right now. It's not it has to be noticed by if we were to amend the policy. Is that what you're saying?
I don't think that – Bruce and I were just speaking briefly. I don't think that the cancellation policy is – the Planning Commission is addressed in the Muni Code, but I don't believe the cancellation policy is in the Muni Code. I believe it's only in the Council Policy and Procedure Book.
We cancel meeting, for example, a good meeting. If we don't have a quorum, we cancel the meeting because we just don't – there's no purpose in meeting. So you know, we can cancel those meetings if we don't have anything to put on the agenda. And, again, a lot of the times we don't find out until the last moment. They're not ready to go.
Perhaps, and I mean, I'd be interested in looking at how we could amend it to allow for a later cancellation date and where that fits in with our AGP contract also in the time we need to notice them for a cancellation, what our obligation would be there financially. But certainly if there's not enough, I mean, I'm a little concerned as to why we only had 3 approved projects come through and we still are contracting out a couple projects if we're not getting things through, but I guess that's another issue. You know, I don't want staff
again,
to have
a lot
to come
of that
out.
Is just waiting for it to come back from other agencies,
nope.
And when it does, pop.
But I'm saying we're still contracting out to other RDM or whoever are already in San Luis, but yet we don't seem to have enough going through the system, so I don't know why we're still having to outsource some of it. But I'd like to look at the possibility of amending it so we could push the date later.
I think Kathleen had a response there.
Well, I just think that I need to say a few things here. One is that, you know, we anticipate getting up to speed and taking applications through quicker and faster to Planning Commission. You need to keep in mind that well, I've been here now for about 8 or 9 months, that Janine's been here for only 2, and that during the summer I was mostly here by myself, which meant that I was going to the counter and not at my desk sitting writing reports. So I think that we need to not take something that's sort of atypical and out of the ordinary and then expand it to being something that, you know, I would hope that we realize is just out of the ordinary and not common. you know, we're a department of two people, and when you're down to one, the one person's pretty much running around like a chicken with his head cut off, you know, going to the counter, doing noticing, publishing, posting. And so you're kind of like envision like a one-man band, you know, and so you're not sitting writing reports. So now that there's two of us here and we've been here for 2 months, I hope that you can anticipate that things will dramatically change. But keep in mind that in order for some projects to come forward, just like the presentation we gave tonight on CEQA, an initial study is a 30-some page document. It becomes ancillary to when you people see it. It's an attachment. But we're working on that 30-page document. We have to be thorough. We have to read all the studies that go with it. And so there's a lot of quiet time that is required. And so we're working all the time. We're not slow. If you see that list is getting bigger. Not only that, but we have a high standard of personal or public service here, you know. And so some of these projects, as Bruce is saying, we're waiting for them to come back or they're still continued. There is a lot of meeting with applicants and meeting again. And so we try to put that in our workload in the project under description, how many times we've had to meet with people. And we've tried to not cut that down at all and to expedite things. But I would like to just reassure you that now that there's both of us here and things should go back into the mainstream, and we anticipate robustly taking those projects forward for you.
Okay. Betty or Noah, anything? Betty?
Yes, I like to pick up on the idea of using meetings that aren't scheduled for projects as work time, either on urban forest management plan, FAR, any of those projects that are long-term projects that haven't gotten done that these commissioners could work on. And it might be that until things get back to normal, that maybe the first meeting of every month would be scheduled for projects that come through the system, and the second meeting would always be scheduled for some kind of work project where they're looking at issues that we would like for them to examine. And then if something comes up and is available because someone got their stuff.
Every time there's a meeting, to advise people, you know, please before our next meeting, check our website. If there has been any lack of documentation for the issues at hand, we will be canceling, and you'll know as of Wednesday. I think just an announcement like that, something like that to add to our policy could probably cover us there. As far as working on other projects, that's sort of a mixed blessing because, yes, you can do research, as has been done perhaps on the visioning. I think that was a good example of something that the commission subcommittee could do, or the commission as itself can do that kind of research, looking at previous documents and putting them together. It's hard when you start forming new policy because without the input of the people who know all the laws and regulations and terminology and everything, you might be spinning your wheels and end up having to go back and say, oh, that doesn't work because. So it's a fine line, and I would guess it would be up to staff if there are projects that there can be some research done and things like that, that would be good to do on those downtimes. But otherwise, you don't want to do something that's going to be spinning wheels because you didn't know the regulations and concerns that you had to deal with in the first place. So
I kind of like to expand on what you just said. I think we could probably agree that the change in cancellation policy is something we'd like to see. I think the problem with working on, we have this long list, our advanced planning work program, and it doesn't change much. The thing is, if in fact there are not projects out there that need to be worked on, then that's fine to move into FAR or safety element or AB811 or whatever, you know, and make that one of our meetings. But it's kind of like you said, if in fact there are projects that people want done and that the planning department is working on, it's not right to pull them away from those so that on the second meeting of every month we can do the advanced planning. Yet, if we hit the point where there are not projects out there, we'd certainly love, when we need to see some of this stuff anyway, somehow, sometime. But I know they're busy getting projects together. That's my final comment on the subject. Anybody else? Jamie.
Yes. So just addressing the issue, if we were to go to one meeting a month, and due to a slow period here, how do we manage something like that from a standpoint? Do we say we're going to just do this until things pick up? Do we set a time that we're doing this? If we have projects that come up and we say, well, we have three that are ready, we can only do two this meeting, and that now we're going to have a second meeting this month. I guess that just those are questions that I'm asking. I just want to address right now.
I think we're looking at a consensus that would be the other way around.
Yeah.
What we're looking at is the ability to cancel at the last minute if there is nothing going on. But it seems to me the consensus that I heard was that we wanted to keep the two meetings and just be able to cancel the second one if, or the first one, if nothing happens, so that within that window between Wednesday and Monday, we could be able to cancel a meeting.
Well, and then I guess my question to staff, just to clarify, it looks to me, looking at our list, like there are quite a few projects out there. For example, I think next week we have at least three,
right,
plus maybe the marina project. So it's not a lack of projects. I think it's more like Kathleen said, we have new staff getting going here and catching up and getting up to speed. And if for whatever reason things can't be ready in time, if you guys will change the cancellation policy for us so that it can be canceled rather than sitting here for 12 minutes and 10 seconds.
Okay, so I think that's a future agenda item for us, which we could probably decide on right now, right? So let's suggest that. I would suggest that as a future agenda item. We change that policy about cancellation so that we can have short time periods. And we'll have it whenever it comes up at our meeting.
And I'd support that.
Okay. Do I get a third?
I just have a question. Are you talking about only for Planning Commission or for all the boards?
I think all the boards. It would be a policy change. It's harder with the others because they only meet once a month. So it's a little bit harder there, but we could discuss that at the agenda item.
We'll bring forward all the options, and then the council can make okay. changes. Like I said, we've got some other changes to make to that policy manual. It's on my desk, so we'll just bring it forward.
Okay. So do I have a third person supporting that? Rick? Yes, okay. All right, so that'll be that.
Oops. Before we move on to the next one, there was a part to get on you'd like the city council to address at some time?
I had sent that email and recognized that none of these items might make the agenda, and I was happy to have one, so I'll leave it at that. And if city council wants to bring it back in 6 months or whenever we meet again as a joint committee, we can discuss it then.
All right, then. Moving on.
Right, the pedestrian plan.
Yes, who wanted to talk about the pedestrian plan? Wasn't that you, Jerry Lohr?
No, it was
Jamie, maybe.
I brought that up. I wanted to address this. This has been on our planning matrix in the pipeline, and it was addressed as a planning commission item. Being new, it would just come up meeting after meeting, and I just wanted to address it and bring it before the council and to staff to find out really where we are on this, what the status of it is, and if we could get direction from council on where we'd want to move forward on this. Having said that, I think it was pretty notable in the visioning presentation, at least to me, that in almost every document that was brought forth in that presentation, there was some element about a pedestrian element. So that tells of the need for that particular topic. And so we have a pedestrian plan it's in the pipeline. I'm not really that familiar with it other than it is an item for the Planning Commission, and I just wanted to bring it forth to the council to discuss their input and priority and maybe get staff input on the status of that is. Thank you.
I think we'll go for the staff status first.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I really don't recall this that clearly. My recollection is that this started off Originally, when we were talking about the topic of sidewalks and whether they applied to single-family and R2 zones, and then somewhere along in that discussion, we kind of got shifted over to this concept of pedestrian paths. It is an important part of the circulation element. And I was talking to Rob Leivick earlier, see if he remembered much about this. So I'm sorry, I don't really recall all of the movement on this. My recollection was there was a subcommittee of PWAB members and then perhaps a planning commissioner or two that were kind of talking about this, but I don't know if the plans materialized. If they had, we haven't seen them. I can also tell you, though, that there has been, Rob indicated, there was other legislation that requires, accessibility. And that's a key part of the circulation element. So one way to look at this is perhaps we could bring that topic back when we got into the circulation element or the general plan or something. I mean, because that's where that kind of component, I believe, probably belongs. But it really is up to you folks. If it's that big of a priority, we can certainly make it number one. But again, that wasn't something that we brought up. It was a Planning Commission item. So, and it has been on there for quite a while. I'm sorry, I just don't remember any more about that.
I'm wondering if, because I'm trying to remember the history of it too, and I know there were discussions about what constitutes a pedestrian walkway, whether it can be decomposed granite or whether it has to be paving, and if a building here has it, a building here has it, and somebody in between wants to do a minor addition, do they have to do the sidewalk? There were all of those issues, and I maybe this came from all of those questions.
That was part of it, but the interpretation from the city engineer that we have is that ADA has been defined more precisely, right. And I'm not quite sure that those old standards still apply.
Betty, were you remembering differently than that?
No, it's very nebulous to me. I do not remember it even being an issue that we addressed, and if it was, it was a long time ago. And
I think it was more on the Planning Commission that they were grappling with it.
This being, again, the senior member of this commission, I can remember when other commissioners were concerned about the fact that there were sidewalks in some places and not in others, and there was not really a good pedestrian circulation in town. Also part of it was the pathways to the school down Greenwood, as I remember, that got mixed into all of this. It is something that has always remained on the Planning Commission list but never moved up, to anything that City Council advised or suggested any. Yeah. Well, it's part of the circulation element, but it's the updated bike plan. Mm-hmm. If that makes any sense, that's my suggestion. And then we take it off our list of things to do because we're not doing anything with
it. Rick, you got a comment?
Just that, it's my understanding that the general plan also takes into consideration the circulation plan, which takes into consideration the ADA, the bike paths, the sidewalks, and all this stuff. And things have happened with ADA since we really took a look at how all these things intermingle. So, and it reminds me when you're talking about other agenda items to look at when there's not stuff going on. I mean, why not take a look and update this kind of thing when there's nothing going on? So this is certainly something I think screams for updating because things have happened since we've updated it previously. So that would be where I'd like to go with it.
I think, though, as a planning commission, what we need at this point is action from city council to move it from planning commission list to somewhere, wherever it goes, probably at the bottom of the advanced planning work list.
But when you do that, doesn't that assume that then falls back on staff? And I see it more as a project for you all, that you guys could examine that initially just as you did the visioning. why not you sure. look at the circulation element and see where the error, where not the errors, but where the holes are.
With your permission, I think we'd be glad to. Yes, Jamie.
I guess that's kind of what I wanted to ask for as well, the direction that Ms. Winholtz was voicing just now.
Is that something also, that staff could just provide those documents for them to read and catch up on where we are?
Absolutely. I just want to remind you, we have code on the books now where we've eliminated the requirement to build sidewalks for homes and in the R2 district for a single family in R2. So it's not as simple as just saying
right.
there's other things involved that kind of complicate the situation. But following up on Commissioner Johnson's suggestion, asking that committee or that to come forward as a consideration with the bike plan is probably maybe a little bit better of a place than where it is now. Because Robson, he's shepherding that project through now, and he will do the bike plan, which would ultimately get added to the circulation element. But the bike plan he's working on is really a funding mechanism too, and we can adopt that adjunct to the general plan and still be eligible for funding. And Rob's pretty conversant with the Safe Routes to Schools program and so forth. So that, I mean, he's not here. I mean, not that.
So we can assign him to do it. He's
but,
not here.
But that really might be a good place to look at it in a broader context because he's real familiar with the sidewalk issue.
Well,
ADA.
And I know he's working on that bike plan with the bike committee input, you know, Red, what's his name?
Robert.
Yeah,
Robert Davis
and that committee. And I'm certainly, maybe Jamie could have input or a couple of planning commissioners who are particularly interested. I'd work with you on that one. Maybe can we work with the bike committee?
I actually see them as two different items. When you're dealing with pedestrians, where there's sidewalks, where there's not sidewalks, where there's just a community path, I think that's different from where bikes can go. Because they're more limited than where sidewalks may or may not be, or where bike lanes may be class 1, 2, or 3. And though they're related, and hopefully pedestrians and bicyclists can use joint areas, I think to begin with they're actually two different items.
Well, I think, though, too, that goes kind of back to a philosophical question that I remember sort of getting in trouble for years and years ago, and that was, do we want sidewalks all over town, or do we want the asphalt berms? I mean, there was basically a philosophy in Morro Bay, I understand, that we didn't want sidewalks everywhere, right? Bruce's.
And that would be, and that would be part of the discussion that the commission would have.
Well, and I think that it's both. I think that there can be a combination of, especially on Main Street going north, of the bike plans and the bicycle paths as well. Because obviously that's needed. It works very well on the Harbor Walk, so we know it can happen. But I agree, there are other places where we need pedestrian plans where we may not be doing the bike path. But I think that would be fine if a couple of people worked with the bike committee on places where that could be combined, if staff feels that that's reasonable.
So do I understand that instead of having a pedestrian plan, there would be a bike and pedestrian plan combined? Is that what I hear? Or we
not
want to set, make sure that they're...
It's the first step.
It seems to me that there was legislation that requires the sidewalks. So there are other moving parts that I'm not familiar with. I mean, it's not surprising at all, but that there is, you know, a requirement to have sidewalks. We're certainly in favor of it. But that may, at any rate, that might be helpful because he knows more about that.
And maybe that's the starting point to have Rob give a report to the Planning Commission, give them whatever documents are available on what we have right now. And as far as a pedestrian plan and whatever the new laws are, and then they can kind of combine that in, whether it's with the bike path plan or separate.
Or not. Yeah. As in different, either combine it or not, depending on what the needs are and where the needs are. Would that work for you?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Is the council in agreement on that as a plan? Okay.
All right.
Next.
This is Jamie again. Graywater systems and permitting.
I think you asked that that be on here.
I did, and I brought this forth during one of our commission planning commission meetings, and part of the topic was introducing the Gray Water Systems Workshop, the information out there. This we had a Gray Water Program Workshop, and I felt there was merit in promoting that throughout the city. And part of this item here was, in fact, discussing the possibility of waiving the permitting fee to encourage more people to participate in that. Having said that, I spoke with Dan Doris, and you know, there might not be merit in waiving the permitting fee, but if in an effort to promote the program, perhaps we could have a presentation brought forth to the council meeting as such that was done at the workshop that would be televised for the public, and that at least would get the information out there.
Noah, would you like to weigh in on that one?
Sure. I actually am excited that this item was on the agenda, and that's why one of the reasons why I stayed online. When we developed this the presentation, working with Mr. Doris or Dan, as he wanted me to call him, and the Green Build, we did not at that point have the funding for it to be broadcast. So it was a well-attended meeting. We had about 62 people show up from the public and also building professionals, contractors, and the enthusiasm was high. I think if we wanted to have an update at the council that was in a broadcast sort of a venue, Mr. Doris could probably do an excellent job at being there and guiding us through the general summary of what we talked about at that presentation. I'm sure if we were to invite and request Slow Green Build to come out, they would send a representative as well. So those are some options for us that we could agendize down the road. I'm also interested the future agenda item that we have that will be updating our Green Building Incentive Program. That could be a good point to try to coalesce these two topics together and have some more information to work with and decide further ways that we could promote these systems or other opportunities in the community.
Okay. Well, Mr. Doors is here, and he's been nodding. So, not nodding off. He's been nodding in attention. So, Council, is that something? Would you like to see a presentation on that at some time?
No. I mean no, because I'd like to see it go to the Planning Commission, who seems to have more time available right now, since they have some gaps in their meeting schedule right now, and then it could be televised through them. Okay. And then maybe later we could get it updated. I mean, that would be my suggestion, as we have a pretty full agenda coming up the next few meetings.
Bruce, did you have a question?
Yes, Madam Mayor. Just to let you know, that's already being scheduled for the Public Works Advisory Board, too.
So, oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah, it's already they were already planning that.
Good.
So.
All right. Betty?
And that's great, and I agree with Ms. Borchard that the Planning Commission gets a lot of time on the TV. People watch it, and that would be a good place for it.
Rick? Thank you.
Just a quick comment on the permitting process. The plan and inspection for the gray water system, we've taken down 20% from $79 down to about $63, and that really just covers our what we do as far as the plan and inspection of it. So it has been brought down, and the rebate program is still up there, where you get the $100 off on water savers and dishwashers and clothes washers and all this stuff. So there are incentives out there, and our plan and inspection prices have been taken down too. I agree that this is why
the Public Works Advisory Board. But the item on the pedestrian pathway, we'd probably agendize as kind of a work, more of a working piece of the agenda.
So a that public hearing item.
Right,
then.
So we can get direction and respond to different things versus the presentation on gray water systems, I suppose.
Okay.
So one would be a presentation, the other would be a working
would
agenda
be a
item.
Hearing item. All right, that sounds good. All right, guys, you're going to be busy.
Well, they wanted to be busy, right? All right, the last item we had on our list was affordable housing workshop, and I know we've tossed this item around a lot, and I'm not sure who asked that it be on the agenda. Was it you? Wasn't John? Yes.
I'll make a comment on that.
Please do. Let's have some comments.
This was also in one of the items on the housing element that just went through, and it's basically was in the housing element that said, you know, that we would. Mr. Ambo, maybe you can address a little bit better whether or not we were obligated to do a workshop, but it was in the document about doing an affordable housing workshop. So I want to throw that out there as well, given the fact that there were some comments relating to what was the price tag to affordable housing. Was it low income? Was it moderate income? I know, Ms. Johnson, you commented on that during our meeting. Ms. Winholtz as well, I think made a comment on whether it would be low-income housing or moderate-income housing. And if it is in the document that we approved as in the housing element document, maybe an affordable housing workshop would be beneficial not only for all of us but even the public as well.
Mr. Lucas, any comments?
No, my recollection was when we did the housing element, there was a lot of discussion as there were small pools of money to assist developers with affordable housing, and I'm sure most of them are aware of these programs, but it's always good to make sure the public knows that these pools of money are available as well.
Okay. Diodati? Mr. Lohr? Comment. Okay, I think basically, that's where it came from. When we were working on the housing element, there were so many references to having affordable housing or making affordable housing available. And I think we need to have a discussion and how you recommend that we facilitate that, I don't know. But a discussion on how we're going to reach some affordability, what it means, you know, numbers-wise, dollars-wise, and where would you like us to go with this?
Is that the kind of information that could also be a presentation item to the Planning Commission?
Absolutely. What I was thinking more directly on is our affordable housing rehab program. That we have money, and we're trying to get the word out, and we've been trying to get the word out, so that may be a starting point. Okay. And we've just funded a couple. Christine's just funded a couple mobile home rehabs. So I think that would be real productive, and we can go over the funding sources and the income levels. Kind of the nature of the beast is the high price of land, and that's always been the problem. But maybe we can package it and focus it more on the rehab programs, and certainly we'll be on hand to answer any of those kinds of questions we can about the concept of affordable housing. And we have some funding sources available. So we could schedule that for kind of presentation, working session, something like that.
Okay. Any other comments from council on that one?
If they want to do it, go for it.
Okay. I think that's it on our list.
That's it.
Okay. Anybody have any concluding remarks they want to make?
I'd just like to thank ADP Video and you guys for allowing me to sit in on this.
Bob is being very appreciative.
Yes. How's the weather up there? Is it raining?
Surprisingly, no.
Okay, thanks for attending by phone, Noah.
Yes.
And with that, Carla?
I have a request for council for agendizing an item for Monday night, if possible, if I can get support. We received a letter requesting a reduction on parking and lot fees on a project on Morro Bay Boulevard, and if we have time to bring it forward Monday night, I'd like to see if we could. Well, it's not Mr. Vesterfeld's project, but it's
the 14th, correct?
Yes. 600 Morro Bay Boulevard. Yeah. We all received a letter. If we could address that.
Right, yeah, I would agree with that. Let's put on the agenda.
Is it time sensitive?
Well,
What?
Christine reminded me, that meeting is January 4th.
Uh-oh.
And our next meeting will be here.
All right. Okay. We are adjourning to here next Monday, right. December 7th at 6 o'clock. Okay. Do not go to the community center if you're looking for
not
us.
Not until January.
Not until January.
Okay. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.